Regular listeners to the Rhythm and Blues Review are familiar with the public TV shows Doo-Wop 50 and Doo-Wop 51, and more recently, Rock Rhythm and Doo-Wop. With me on the phone is the man that's not only behind the scenes of these fine shows, but it's also out in front during the pledge breaks, TJ Labinski. Good evening. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, how does somebody that's so young like yourself have such a fanatical desire for the sounds of the 50s and 60s, the R&B, doo-wop, and rock and roll?
I think I have the same desire that you do and that your listeners do. I mean, you just hear a song and it strikes a chord. There's just something that hits a place in your heart and you have to hear it and you have to find out like more about the whoever recorded it. And then from there you buy like the 45, and then after the 45 you buy their greatest hits, and then after the greatest hits you have their album, and then you love them so much you seek all the rare good stuff, and then you're hooked. That's pretty much how it happened for me. And I'm so young, I never had a chance to see one of the Alan Freed shows on stage. I have no idea what it was like to see guys like Big Al Sears followed by Joanne Campbell or Jimmy Clanton followed by the Cleftones or the Nutmegs or something. I mean, it had to be an awesome thing. And all I'm trying to do is just capture that, put it on tape so that people will have it in the future, because there are no tapes of the old Alan Freed shows.
What was the influence of your grandfather, Herman Labinski, and his Savoy Records recordings? Did that have anything to do with your interest?
It's hard to say. That stuff was always in the background. And, I mean, now as I'm older, I appreciate it a lot more than when I was younger. I mean, it wasn't in my life every day. My grandfather died a year after I was born. The word is, when he was in the hospital, I pulled his IV out. I really don't have memories of him. I know through my father what he was like because my father worked in his store and was with him throughout all those years. What I really remember about the Savoy stuff is every day of my life, my father would pull out those Savoy 45s. You know, every day my father would be like, oh, you got to hear this. And it's like, I'm just a bad, blah, 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 blah. And it came to the point where I hated that song so much. And then, I don't know, one day I just fell in love with it. And then I had to discover Cherry by the Jive Bombers. And then things like Stardust by Clarence and the guys. So, I mean, it's something that you hear something, it evokes a memory. And I think that's what all this stuff is about. Maybe I didn't live in the 50s or the early 60s, but, you know, I know what it was like to hear a song like This Is My Love by the Passions, or songs like Lullaby by the Chevrons. I mean, those were some of the first songs I can remember hearing on the radio, a little oldie station, the Jersey Shore where I'm from. And that was my sound. I was just hooked. I mean, I still had the same experience of hearing it on the radio for the first time. I mean, granted, it was 40 years later than what was going on in the world, but I still had that moment. I remember where I was. I remember the girl I was seeing. I remember what I did that day. I remember loving, you know, I'll never forget, one of the first 45s I bought was I Love You by the Volumes. And I searched for this 40. This is before CDs were out, and things were hard to find. And I searched for this 45. I went in 90 record stores, downstairs records in Manhattan, asked everybody, have you ever heard of this song? I Love You, I Love You. I didn't know what it was called. And nobody could believe it was called I Love You. And then finally, I went to this place in Florida, desperately trying to find this record, because I heard it on the radio, and I loved it, and they didn't announce what it was. And the guy said, oh, yeah, that's called I Love You. I've gone through those same steps. It just happened to be 40 years later.
So you were originally from the New Jersey area. How'd you end up in Pittsburgh?
Well, actually, I spent all my life until I was maybe around 11 or 12 years old in Bradley Beach, which is right next to Asbury Park, Ocean Grove, that area of New Jersey, the Jersey Shore, South Jersey. And then we moved to Florida when I was 10, but used to spend my summers in Jersey. And then, when I was 15 years old, I quit high school, took a GED, went to college for about a year, and got my first job in New Jersey working for a statewide TV network at that time. And did that for quite a few years, maybe 5 years, and then that led me to a job at the PBS station in West Palm Beach. And it's through my job in West Palm Beach being there 5 years, and that's actually where all the doo-wop stuff started, was in West Palm, on TV anyway. It's as a result of that I was offered a job in Pittsburgh. I had no idea the connection this city had with oldies. I mean, I knew oldies, but I knew them as somebody who grew up between Philadelphia and New York. My influences were people like Don K. Reed, Jerry Blavitt, Hylett to a certain extent, mostly Jerry Blavitt, Harvey Holiday, who taught me a hell of a lot about Motown and doo-wops. So those were the guys that I grew up hearing for the first time. That's how I learned about this stuff, was through their specialty shows. And I just happened to come to a city that this lived and breathed what the music was all about, but I had no idea. That was fate. That was pure fate.
Well, do you find that there's a lot of differences, say, between the oldies fans in Pittsburgh versus the Northeast or Florida?
Yes, most definitely. You got to understand something. When you're from New Jersey, and it's, believe me, I'm a Pittsburgher now, and I love Pittsburgh. It's my home, and it's where I live, and I have affinity for this city. I love this city. But I'm always going to be a Jersey guy. Jersey is something you carry with you in your heart wherever you go, and there's certain things about Jersey that you just do being from Jersey, you know, things like pork roll and cheese and hard rolls and just tar and smell on the beach, and just, there's just things that are that you just carry in your life because you're from Jersey, and that's the way it is. And the boardwalk, and I mean, I spent so much of my time working in nightclubs from the time I was 15 years old on. My Uncle Buzzy, who was a DJ and into the music, used to work in clubs, and I used to DJ with him, and then I started DJing on my own at all these nightclubs like the Yakety Yak, all these places. So to me, the sun rises and falls on Jersey, and that's it, because that's my life, that's my upbringing, that's where I'm from, and you can't take that away. That being said, to me, in Jersey, what do we have? I had the influences of Philadelphia radio, which is a lot of R&B and Motown, but a lot of regional stuff, you know, very specific things that, you know, groups that just came out of Philadelphia. And then on the New York side, it was all white kind of poppy groups, plus the heavier R&B stuff, but it was very heavy, sweet-sounding white groups like the Passions and the Mystics and, you know, people like the Quotations and that sort of stuff. Whereas in Philly, you had people like Lee Andrews and the Hearts. It was a different sort of feeling, but those were my influences. So that's what I have to gravitate to because that's my default. That's how I was taught. When I came to Pittsburgh, it was a shock to me because from New Jersey to Florida, I used to work at all these nightclubs, so I would be used to people that loved oldies, but oldies as I knew them. So when you talk to me about what are my favorite doo-wops, you know, Junior Perillo and the 4Js, Hear My Broken Hearted, and the flip side by Love Possessed. That's, you know, one of the best doo-wops of all time. That's what I live for. Here am I, here am I, my, here am I. That's what I live for. But you come to Pittsburgh and they say, huh? Because they never heard that song. It never got played here. What they played here was a lot of the heavy, hardcore, black R&B, haunting kind of sounds that never went anywhere except for this town. And it's a very different feeling, and that's why these people, I mean, they are. This is not a white pop town. This was a heavy R&B, you know, just unbelievably, you know, songs like Great Googly Moo, you know, things like, you know, I think of the Dubs. Now, I'm from Jersey, man. The Dubs, Don't Ask Me to Be Lonely. Chapel of Dreams, Could This Be Magic is the hit, but, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Beside My Love, that's the Dubs. No, you come to Pittsburgh, no, they don't even know those songs. They never heard of those songs here. Don't Ask Me to Be Lonely, maybe. But the rest of them, Chapel of Dreams, they don't play that stuff. Porky never played it here. Instead, it's Darling. I never heard of that record until I came here. But you know what? It's a great record. And I learned to really appreciate what the sound was all over. Teenage Rock, Ronnie Jones and the Classmates. Mm-hmm. That's the sound of Pittsburgh right there. Jimmy Beaumont and the Skyliners. R&B sounds of white guys. And the list goes on and on and on. You think about the early days of the 50s, you know, Del Vikings really weren't from here. But it's part of that Pittsburgh history, as are so many of the local groups, the Four Dots, the El Capris, Leon Daniels and the Elvinos. You hear songs like Geraldine, it's, oh my God, it's a gritty, raw, raunchy, throbbing, pounding kind of mix of real rhythm and blues. Whereas everywhere else, it's more, I don't know how to describe it. It's just a different sound. It's a different feeling. And so, yes, so Pittsburgh is very different. And I had a lot of learning to do when I came here because, you know, to me, it's funny. I mean, I hear a song like, this happens all the time because, like, everybody's a DJ in Pittsburgh and everybody has a radio show here. And somebody played, it was either Close Your Eyes. It was a Five Keys tune. It was a pretty common Five Keys tune. It was one of those things like, Wisdom of a Fool, Out of Sight, Out of Mind, The Verdict. It was one of those songs in there that we know by the Five Keys. You know, that's Rudy singing. We know it because, you know, I'm from Jersey, and that's Rudy. Get out of here. Here, it's like some white group, you know, that only Porky played and only people know here. And the thing about Pittsburgh is it's staunch in what was here. It hasn't changed. I mean, that is it. There is no change. There is no substitution. There is no evolving. I mean, that's the way it is. So it's a very different learning curve for me, but it's one that I love, and I love more and more every day. I really appreciate it a lot more every day. I mean, certain songs, like, to me, you say The Majors, and I think of A Wonderful Dream.
Mm-hmm.
You come to Pittsburgh, and it's Lundy Dundy by the Versatiles, which is the same group,
right.
I mean, Lundy Dundy. I mean, that's not a New York record. It would never have been a New York record. I mean, it may have been played on some stations. Here, it's like an anthem. Harvey's, Any Way You Wanna. I used to play that in nightclubs. as his electric slide to that song. And here, the Delcoys, Arabia, just across the street to Del Rio's, High on a Hill by Scott English. Is, oh, my God, that song is like the number one song of all time, outbeating things like, here's a classic example, right?
Okay.
I want to bring Earl Lewis and the Channels in. Again, I'm a Jersey guy. What do I think of Earl Lewis and the Channels? First thing I think of, Bye Bye Baby. That's, to me, that's Earl Lewis and the Channels. The Girl Next Door. I'm in love with The Girl Next Door. The Gleam in Your Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That's Earl Lewis and the Channels. Here, no, it's The Closer You Are. Period. Nothing more, nothing less. That's it. That's all I got played. That's My Desire. Hello, that's My Desire. Like, you know, whoa, one of the greatest Get Laid songs ever. Didn't get played here, so it's not recognized here. I mean, it may be a little more now because they got some great, you know, little societies and clubs, and they're really good people doing, you know, bringing some of the groups in, but still, in the mass memory, if Porky didn't play it, it didn't happen here.
Hmm.
Such a huge city, and yet it's a small town. And I had no idea that this truly is the oldies capital of the world, and make no mistake about it. And it's the best place for a guy like me to live. But I had no idea I was coming here.
Hmm.
You walk in a store like Freddie Bond's Attic Record Shop in Millville, just walls and walls and walls of just regional hits that only people, you know, the Vogues, before they became the Vogues, were the Bel-Airs. And like, they're, like, honored, like, as if for us, the only way I could equate it to you is to say, if I'm in Philadelphia, these are like the Dream Lovers. There's been definitely an adjustment, but I can't let go of where I'm from, because there was just certain thing. I guess we were more eclectic, maybe. I don't know. It's just hard to say. It's just a different thing. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a different thing, and I love it all.
TJ, we see you on the pledge breaks, and I know that you're producing the events. Give me a snapshot of what it takes to organize such an incredible show.
Well, money. A lot of money. What you see all the time is, there they go, PBS begging for money again. Why can't they just show the concert? Well, what people don't understand is there is no concert unless we find a way to pay for it. And it all starts with money. So the first thing I got to figure out before I do a show is, okay, where are we going to shoot the show? That's number one. All right, we're going to shoot it at the theater. Okay, well, the theater is going to have a rental charge. Those rental charges are between $60,000 to $100,000 just to rent the theater. Just to rent the theater and have the labor it takes to be able to put the lights up and use the cameras, because it's, you know, all union shops and union facilities, and there is no negotiation. It's either there or you don't shoot in the theater. And it doesn't matter where you shoot, whether it's New York or whatever, for stuff for TV, on the scale that we're doing it and the look of the theaters that we need, that's the first thing I got to figure out is, okay, where am I shooting and how much is the venue going to cost me? That's just one piece of the cost. Then I got to figure out, okay, who's going to be on the show? Who makes sense to have this on the show? Who makes, you know, the greatest sense to be as part of the lineup of this show? And before I even get into who I'd like, who I wouldn't like, what's best, what isn't best, you know, who makes sense to use and all that, I got to figure out how many people can I afford to fly in? You know, people think you get some sort of break from the airlines. You don't. We're paying the same rate as everybody else pays that when you fly. And it's worse for us because most of our travel is in the middle of the week without a Saturday night stopover. So if I got to bring in, say, a group from the West Coast, like the Jackson Cadets, where you have four individuals plus a musical director, that's five people we got to fly in at like $1,000 each. Sometimes it's $2,000 each, just to get them here to do the show. That's just to get them here. And then once they're here, we got to put up in a hotel room. So that's paying four guys for, you know, usually it's a couple hundred a night at least for a hotel room. And they all have to stay in the same general hotel. I mean, that's not even getting into the artists. Then once you know who the artists are, then you got to figure out, can we get the rights to the music? I mean, people think because we're PBS that we don't have to pay for musical rights. Wrong. The problem is we make a home video available. The minute you make a video available, any goodwill that publishers have for you are people that rightfully or wrongfully own the stuff. You get into debates all the time. People say, oh, well, they shouldn't hold this back, or they should put this on CD or whatever else. Well, right or wrong, somebody owns that music, and we can't do something illegal. We have to pay for it. So then we got to negotiate with whoever wrote it, whoever owns the arrangement. In the case of the group, we've had many times where I wanted certain groups to do certain songs, and we couldn't get the rights to the music. Now, the rights are not just for the home video. The rights are the right for us to be able to broadcast this stuff on television, 40 million homes. That's a lot of music rights that we have to buy.
You bet.
Plus the fact when you put it on a home video, people don't give you goodwill because you're PBS. they say, oh, you're making a home video. That's going to be in stores. So you pay full rate or more than the full rate.
No slack at all, huh?
No, because, I mean, they don't see a difference between us and anybody else using a piece of music. I mean, there's no breaks to be had there. Even though we're a nonprofit, that doesn't mean anything to them because it's just a mindset of, hey, this is a commercial venture, period. So we don't get any breaks on that. And then, after that, then I figure out who the groups are. And then when you get to negotiating with the groups don't give you a break because you're PBS. The groups think, oh, it's TV, I should get more money than I normally get when I'm going out. Because it's TV, as if it's some sort of glamorous thing or something. So then we get that part of the cost as well. My air bill alone for the last show we did was close to $180,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's just to fly like 40 groups in or something, and not even 40 groups, 20 groups, you know. And then you've got the cost of the theater and the venue. Then you've got all the labor and their union houses, so you have to use union labor. And then you've got to pay for all the music. And then once you get done with all that, you still got to pay director. You got to pay the camera guys. You pay for the truck. You got to pay for all the audio equipment. And we spend a lot of money on sound production because the one thing I'm not willing to do is put these people on TV in 40 million homes and have them sound bad. I don't want to be responsible for somebody saying, oh, he can't sing anymore. I mean, I'm not going to do that. I have too much respect for the artists and the groups. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars in sound fixing. And not to mention all this is still artist negotiation. They have to get paid. They all get paid on the videotape sales. That's upfront money and advances as well as ongoing royalties. This is not cheap to do. So, you know, you say, well, what do you think about? I wish I could tell you the first thing I think about is, oh, man, let's do a show on all the rare B-sides of the VJ sounds, because that's what I would like to do personally. But the reality is, who's going to pay for that? What's the market for that? And so the first thing I have to think of is, what's the budget and what can we afford? And then once I know who's going to help fund the shows, then I can start to make decisions like, what should the focus of the show be? And then I can go about the real business of trying to pull people together and track them down and convince them to do stuff. And that's the next step. But the first step is money.
What do you think? Which group or artist was the most difficult for you to track down or assemble? And what did you have to do to make it happen?
I have to think because, you know, I was just adding up a list the other day, and it's over 120 vocal groups we've worked with in 2 years.
Wow.
That's a lot of people and a lot of memories, and each one of them has their set of challenges. For example, trying to reunite certain groups are a major, major, major challenge. Because right or wrong, I mean, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with the Copyright Act, but somebody owns the name. And if you use a group that doesn't own the name, well, then what happens? You get sued by the other guy. And if you get sued, there's a risk. And even if it's a bogus lawsuit, if you got to defend it in court, that could cost you more than, you know, 10 groups combined.
Right.
So that's part of the challenge. To get more direct and answer your question, who is the most difficult? Like, I can think of members of certain groups, finding them in trailer parks, finding them in VA clinics, tracking them down, who haven't had anything to do with music for 30 years. That can be challenging. People who have trademark names or trademark issues or can't use their names because they sign their rights away. A lot of times it's not the guy who trademarked the name. It's the artist needed some money 20 years ago and sold his name. I've been going through that with one particular artist for a few years now that I've been dying to use. He's still alive. He sounds great. He makes sense. But he sold his name to somebody else. And therefore, you know, we're not able to use him as much as I really... It's criminal that we can't. The circumstances depend from person to person. I can't get too specific because I wouldn't want to hurt the people involved. But I can just tell you that, you know, the greatest challenges are A, finding people, and B, any legality issues, because unfortunately there's legal problems all over the place with this kind of show.
Well, you know, there's a lot of the groups that have performed on your shows, the Del Vikings, the Channels, the Penguins, that have really increased their bookings just because they're, you know, appearing on your show. And I think that's great. Did you have any idea that your program would ever lead to these groups probably making more money now in some of their appearances than they ever did when they started off?
First of all, you need to understand that we, my number one rule is we are treating people fairly. And I think one of the greatest things that I read was a lady by the name of Kate Karp wrote an article in one of the little, like an oldies forever kind of thing, like what Arlene does kind of thing, but it's a little different.
Uh-huh.
She wrote this thing and she said, you know, there were no stopwatches, there were no promoters worried about the clock or the budget. There was people treated with respect. And that's our number one rule going into this thing, is to say, you know what, we're here to honor you and give you a place in history. I'm sorry for what's happened to you long before I was even thought of, but I'm here to give you the credit and the honor and the recognition you deserve. So that's our number one rule, is treating people with respect, giving them the respect that they deserve. And that means the accommodations, the hotel they stay in. It means when they're on an airplane. It just means treating people, all the food they eat. It just means treating people fairly. That's the biggest thing that we do, is make sure that these are human beings that have been through a lot of really bad stuff. They've been screwed by their record companies. They've been screwed by their managers, screwed by their promoters. And I'm not going to be someone to come in and do that. So to answer your question, part of the goal is to show the world that these people are still alive and they can still do it and they should still do it, and we can't forget it, because if it wasn't for them, there would be no Beatles, there would be no Beach Boys. I don't even like those groups, but the point is, you can't deny their place in history.
That's right.
I don't begrudge the Rolling Stones. I mean, they made a major contribution to America. It's not my sound. For me, my sound is the Avalons, My Heart's Desire. But I can't deny them where they are, but we can't deny the fact that they wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for Willie and the Harp Tones, and if it wasn't for Herbie and the Cleft Tones, and if it wasn't for those guys, you know, the Cadillacs, Speedo, if it wasn't for Bobby Lester and Harvey and all those guys, there never would have been those guys. And that's something we can't forget. So part of what I'm trying to do is get in America's face that, hey, these dudes are still out there, or ladies, in the case of Arlene and the girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are still out there, and don't forget them. Do not forget them. That's number one. So I would hope, when you ask me the question, you know, they're getting increased bookings. I hope so. That's the goal. If they're not getting more bookings, we're not doing our job. That's part of what we need to do, is support them as human beings, let people know that, hey, you better respect these people, because if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be living in the country we're living in. And number three, isn't it great that they're available to come into your town or whatever it is? And so I think that's part of our agenda here, is really to help the artists. It's not a one-night stand.
Do you have a certain criteria that you use for groups that appear on your show? You know, say as far as original members. Do you...
Yeah. Yes. Our number one criteria, number one across the board, is that it's got to be an original group, or in the cases where we can't get original groups, and there's a lot of legal reasons that prevent us, like it or not, from using them, we always have to get an original member recording on the record. If the person wasn't on the record, we're not interested in the group. That's my number one rule in building these shows. And then after that, it's just the theme of the particular show. But I can give you many examples where this has happened. Randy and the Rainbows, the Orioles. I had a situation where we had heard that Johnny Reed's group was out there, and Johnny was alive, and he was the guy with the Orioles name. And we looked into it, and as far as we could tell from all the sources, Johnny was the guy. And a week before the show, I get a call from Tiz Russell. He says, well, I'm the guy. Well, okay, well, all right, but Johnny was on Crying in the Chapel, and, you know, Diz was before him. If it wasn't for Diz, there would have been no Johnny. But if it wasn't for Johnny, they're the ones who had the hit. So what do you do? They're both legitimate groups. I mean, they both have some claim to the name, and it was Diz's group who, I believe, trademarked the name in that case. Like, I might be jumbling some of the details because it's been a few years, but this is a typical example of what happened. So here I am on both sides of the phone, where I had to call Diz and say, I really want to have you on the show, but I can't do it unless you're with Johnny. And I had to call Johnny and say, I really want you on the show, because we can't do a show for history called Doo Wop 51 and not honor the Orioles. And one of the guys is like 85 years old. And so that's an example where we had to forge a marriage. Randy and the Rainbow, same thing. There's like two Randys, you know. But the real Randy, we were able to get him to Dominic Cifuta. We were able to get him to go with Mike Zero and reunite. Drifters, same story. The reason you haven't seen Benny King on the doo-wop shows is because he would never perform with Charlie Thomas. I wasn't going to put Benny King on a show without Charlie Thomas. This was my dream. This was my goal.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through the first show, wasn't interested. Second show, wasn't interested. Third show, wasn't interested. Finally, we just did a show called R&B 40. And after Benny had a chance to see what we've done with our work before, he said, you know what? I want to do this for history. I want to do this. This is something my grandchildren can see. And we were able to get him to rejoin Charlie for the first time in a lot of years. I mean, it's never happened on TV. There's one film clip of him with the Drifters back in 1960. That's it.
Hmm.
And now we've got five of their songs recorded on tape that people can, Benny King with the Drifters. And not just performing There Goes My Baby, but This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, and my personal favorite, I Count the Tears. So there it is, the record of Benny King with the Drifters, the living record, once and for all. But I wasn't going to have a part of him until it was done the right way. Again, my number one rule is original people, original people, original people. And you start out, like anything, you start out with a very staunch rule of saying, I'm looking for all the real guys. But you got to recognize that these people had bad relationships. Sometimes it's like a divorce, you know. I have been divorced, but I understand for people who have been divorced that there's things that go wrong in life, and sometimes you don't want to be with certain people again, certain things you can't overcome. And you can't forge that. If people don't want to be together, you can't make them be together. So in those cases, you just try to make the best decision, and that's what we've done with each one of these situations. Fortunately, sometimes God is with you, as in the case of the Diamonds, where I called Dave Somerville. And I said, Dave, my goal is to see you back with the Diamonds. And he says, oh, I've been out with the Diamonds before. I said, no, Dave, I understand that all three of the original guys are still alive, Ted and Bill. You know, you're all still around. And he said, well, that's true, but, you know, those guys haven't been with the Diamonds since 1957, since the record. I said, well, can we try to get them out? And he said, okay, I can make it happen. And he did. He was a man of his word. And then, after that, I said, now, Dave, I just got to say one thing, and you got to know I'm with you on this. Little darling, what you did and what you meant to the music is phenomenal, but we can't forget Maurice's part in all this. How do you feel about having Maurice join you on this song? And he said, sure. So that's an example of a great marriage where Maurice wrote the song and performed, and the Zodiacs, or his current group of Zodiacs, with the Diamonds. I mean, that was a piece of history, and that's where it goes good. Those are the good ones you like. George Williams and the Times, same thing, where the Times were in Philly, George was in England. I called him up in England. I said, George, I'm doing this show. I really want to bring you over. If you don't want to come over, I understand, but I don't want you to see this show in 10 years and say, why didn't they invite me? And George said, sure, I'll come. And then I talked to the Times, and they said, yeah, we would love to have him. It's been, you know, 25 years. And that's what I try to do wherever I can. You can't always do it because some people won't let you. And in those cases, you got to go with who the main talent is. For example, Earl Lewis and the Channels. Well, Earl Lewis and the Channels. If Earl has a current group and he owns the name, I can't dictate to him what he does with that. I can only do my best to try to get the right people there, and we try to do that 100% of the time. It just, we're not always successful, but we try.
You were talking about your next show. Anything you can tell us about that one?
Yeah, actually, you'll be the first to hear this. Nobody knows about it yet. We haven't told anybody in the media, but I think I can reasonably share it with you. Because of the events of September 11th last year, which were just devastating and tragic to the country, PBS and ourselves are in some serious discussions to do a concert which acknowledges American singers and American music of the 50s and 60s. So our new program is going to be called Red, White, and Rock, an American tribute to the 50s and 60s. And on this show will be many acts from the 50s and many acts from the 60s. Now, I need to preface this for the doo-woppers out there, because you need to understand there's many, many people with many, many interests. And the more people that you get with the most interest, the more likely you are to be able to come back and do more shows. That's the reason I had to expand the show from the doo-wop shows to the rock, rhythm, and doo-wop shows. And I'll tell you more about that in a second. But the way this show is setting up, and it's not 100% official, but it's looking pretty likely, is that during the week of September 11th, we're going to have this kind of this national, fun, not a very serious, you know, concert for America, a fun celebration of the greatest American rock and roll and rock and roll songs of the 1950s and 60s. Now, that's rock and roll. Rock and roll is a lot of things. Rock and roll is street corner harmony, it's pop, it's R&B, and it's bubblegum. It's all those things. And that's what this show is going to be. It will feature a very intense tribute and focus to the doo-wop days. In fact, there's a whole section of the show which is going to be dedicated just to doo-wop. And then there's going to be actually a separate video of only hardcore doo-wop stuff. as well as on the same show, there'll be all these other elements of the 50s and 60s. And the reason for that is because we really do need to appeal to the masses as much as we can, because it's touching into everybody's interests. That's going to allow us to come back and do more. So that all being said, I might be able to give you a little idea as to who's pretty much involved on the doo-wop side of it. And just keep in mind, this is about expanding. You know, it was like the doo-wop 51 show. I really started to feel this way with doo-wop 51. Something was telling me in my gut that we had an opportunity to get Betty Everett. And it was sort of out of a tribute to Jerry Butler, too, because that meant so much to people. Betty Everett wasn't doo-wop. She had nothing to do with doo-wop. And,
right.
And was she appropriate to have on that show? I think so, because of what she meant with Jerry Butler. Is she pure doo-wop? No. You know, 6 months after we taped the show, she died.
Right.
Had we not done that, that never would have happened, because it was the first time she was on stage in 40 years. I'm glad we did it. And I'm glad the people that love her and what she meant and what the two of them meant to the sound and to the time and to the era we did it. If you ask me my personal favorites, I'm going to give you names like the Harptones, you know, the Dells, you know, people like the Flamingos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's my interests. But I can't do a show on the B-side of hits, because they may be big in a certain part of the country. They may be big amongst collectors. They're not going to be big everywhere. And this show has to play equally as well in Iowa, where they didn't have Little Richard's versions of songs. They had Pat Boone's versions of songs, as it does in New York, as it does in Philadelphia. That's my challenge.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm held accountable to. It's a tough place to be sometimes. These are groups that are on the list, but aren't 100% done yet.
Okay.
And in some cases, they're groups I'm still going after, that I haven't completely contacted yet. The Chords, which I think is really important for this show.
Yeah.
The Dream Lovers, the Fireflies, Aquatones, Little Caesar and the Romans. And we're going to put him with Joe Jones from the Pentagons.
Ah.
Nobody left from that group, but they're all sort of West Coast guys. Quintones, Rosie and the Originals, arguably doo-wop. The Shields, the Solitaires.
What a lineup.
Yeah, and there'll be another at least 15 or more doo-wop groups in this show. But those are some of the more hardcore. I'm sorry, Joe Greer on the Charts.
Mm.
He's locked in. There's others like that, of that kind of stature and magnitude, that we're getting close with or we're about to finalize, or in some cases let them know that it's going to work out okay. And those are the definites. And then I've got some other things going on for the doo-wop people. But you got to remember, for the overall big show, doo-wop is only part of this, because doo-wop is part of the American rock story. It's the foundations of it. It's the roots of it. But it's not the whole story. So on the same show, you're going to see people like Bruce Chanel, people like Clarence Frogman Henry, people like the Essex, Ruby and the Romantics, I just found Ruby, people like Jack Scott, people like Jimmy Jones, people like Jimmy Ruffin, you know, from the Motown side of things.
Wow.
People like the Olympics, people like Otis Williams and the Charms. We're working on a very big reuniting, if we can make that happen, of a very popular girl group of the 60s. People like Frankie Valli. There's that whole side of it. But then there's the later 60s rock side of it, too, which I don't expect everybody to like. But you got to understand, there's people that will hear a song from Danny and the Juniors, and they'll also like the song they're going to hear from the Dream Lovers. So we have to be willing to accept that. You know, the Four Tops are likely to be on this show as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of people from the late 60s, the mid 60s, the early 60s, and the 50s that will be a part of this thing, because it's a tribute to American rock and roll of the 1950s and 60s. But that means, you know, national groups with national hits that were a part of our life. This is a very eclectic mix of kind of what rock, rhythm, and doo-wop was, where you had rock and roll, you had doo-wop, and you had rhythm and blues. This is the same sort of thing, only it's much expanded, because it will also have people like Johnny Rivers, people like Jimmy Clanton, people like the Rascals, people like the Toys. You know, the Toys aren't doo-wop. They're a girl group of the 60s, but they belong because they're part of American rock and roll.
Right.
Three Dog Night, same sort of things. It's part of telling that story. So this show will, like no other show before it, really tell the story. Now, I'm not at the point yet where I want to start repeating groups. I guess you could say, well, why don't you bring the Platters back to do something? Or Johnny Maestro. Well, we had Maestro on already. He did 16 Candles. He did Worst That Could Happen. I would much rather try to get someone like the Charts to come back and do Desiree than start repeating just yet. Now, eventually, we're going to have to get into that because we have lots of groups that had 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hits. But I want to get everybody we can get first at least once before we start going down that road.
Well, I remember you telling us earlier in the interview about all the different things that you had to do to get this show together. And I think one that may not have been touched on was the fact that you've got to find all these people. You've got to contact all these people. That's got to be an amazing amount of work just in itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's easy when they're out and working. It's not when they're not. For example, Ruby Nash. It took me 3 years to find her, and I finally found her. And I called her, and I said, Miss Nash, my name is TJ Lubinsky, and, you know, I do these shows on PBS, and we'd really much like to talk to you. And she said, honey, I haven't sang those songs in 35 years. And this lady sounded so sweet, and she had the same voice. I mean, she clears a bell. And I said, Ruby, it would mean the world if we could get you just come out for one song. And here's what the woman said to me. She says, sweetheart, the guys that I was with, there was 5 of us in the beginning, and I'm the oldest of all 5. They're all dead. They all died. I'm the last one. And I said, well, that's why it's really important you come out to Pittsburgh in May. And she said, okay. Now, you may say, well, what does that mean? Well, what it means is it means the lady who gave us things like, Hey There, Lonely Boy, Young Wings Can Fly, My Summer Love, things like my favorite, When You're Young and in Love, or, of course, the big hit everybody knows, Our Day Will Come, will be recorded for history. She's nowhere else, but we're going to have her for that one moment in time. Skeeter Davis, again, you got to remember, it's a expanded show. I don't expect the person who loves Otis Williams and the Charms singing Gumdrop to love Skeeter Davis singing The End of the World. But you got to understand, there's people that will relate to that in parts of the country where, to them, that gives them that feeling that we were talking about, that, say, we have for something by Anthony and the Sophomores or something. So the point here is that she said, Mr. Lubinsky, I've been praying you would call. And I said, I really felt weird. I'm like, first of all, I'm not even a mister yet. I'm 29 years old. And I said, Miss Davis, please, I don't know what to say to that. You're the talent here. You're the star here. You know, she said, I have stage 4 cancer, and, you know, my song means so much to me, and I want people to know that what my contribution was all about. And we're going to give her that opportunity with this show. That's what this is about. And there'll also be some legends, too, that we're trying to work on as well, people like Fats Domino and some others like that really belong on this kind of show. And again, it's a lot of times it's convincing people because they have ideas as to what they should be doing or not be doing with their careers.
Right.
You know, I'd like to set the record straight on a couple of things that I have heard or I've seen, and I really pay attention to kind of the pulse of what people think. And I don't know if people fully understand that I am with them on a lot of issues, but you have to make business decisions, you have to make legal decisions, and you have to make decisions for the masses. You can't make decisions that drives you as a fan sometimes, even though you prefer other things, because it's the masses that are going to allow for the masses. And I hate to sound that way, because it sounds to me like what those program directors used to say at the radio station, where they said, well, we can't play Love Potion No. 9 by the Clovers because more people would rather hear the Searchers do it, and our research says that blah, 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 blah. And that, to me, that's what I sound like when I say that. But the fact is, when you go into a room of 80 people, now granted, they're not the same people as you and I. Some of them are, some of them aren't.
Right.
And they got a dial, and they crank it up to 10 when the Searchers comes on, and they hear the Clovers, and they put it down to 4 because it just sounds too old to them. You have to pay attention to that, too. I don't agree with it, but you have to pay attention to that, too, because in certain parts of the country, all they know is the Searchers. The Clovers never got played there. What works for New York, what works for California, what works for Philadelphia, what works for Chicago, does not work for Ohio, does not work for North Dakota or South Dakota, does not work for Texas, because these songs weren't played there. Their memories aren't the same there. They didn't have the same kind of thing that the rest of us have. And what I have to do, my greatest challenge, is making these songs and shows accessible to everybody in the country. That's the only way I get to do more shows. And the best example that I can give you is Doo-Wop 50. At the time, it was the number one fundraiser in the history of PBS. It raised $26 million, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also remember, raising $26 million is a gross number because the show cost money. Beyond the show costing money, the premiums cost money. That's the thank you gift. So the box sets cost money. Well, you may just say, oh, well, box sets, well, what is that? Well, you know, you have 101 songs in a box set. That's 101 people that get publishing and royalties and master recordings, and that costs money too. What's the net of that? If you're trying to extrapolate the net of that, you'd be looking at maybe, I don't know, $3 or $4 million after you got rid of all the costs.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to understand that. I mean, there is a business to this that has nothing to do with being a fan. Anyway, so that was the first show. Second show was Doo-Wop 51, and that's a show where I really concentrated more on the R&B side, more on the stuff that I like, the real R&B stuff, than on, you know, kind of the white, poppy, middle-of-the-road stuff. So on that second show, the first show was designed to be like, if you could bring everybody in the world together that made a contribution to this music, and you could only pick 20 groups, who would they be that are available? Who would they be? And that was the first show. The second show is really where I said, you know what, this is about R&B. Let's try to get the Drifters, all the Drifters that were ever Drifters together. Let's get Hank Bauer and the Midnighters on the same stage. The Dubs, you talk about the Sound of New York. The Dells, I mean, the Dells. You talk about the early street corner days of Chicago. The Times, the Clovers, Johnny Keys and the Magnificents, the Orioles. I mean, that was an R&B-focused show. That was more of a hardcore show than the show before it.
Right.
And it only raised a third of the money of the first show. And the problem with sequels is that they get more expensive to make, and they don't get the return. And if there's no return, somebody's got to pay for all these costs that I've described.
Mm-hmm.
So the possibilities of getting a third doo-wop show, I mean, I think the show had raised $7 million or $8 million the second show. And that's a gross number. You got to remember the expenses that I've just described. It means that the net on that is maybe $1 million, $1.5 million. There's a lot of other shows that can be made that will net a lot more money so that PBS overall can do what it does with kids shows and with news and public affairs and all that sort of stuff. The likelihood of getting a third show was slim and none. Because who was going to invest in another show? That was the main challenge. The other challenge was that the artists that we wanted to go after, and I don't want to get into specifics as to who they were, would not do a show that had doo-wop associated with it. And the reason was because they had either retired or been out of it so long they didn't consider themselves a doo-wop artist. They just took offense to the name. Or they were really out and working a lot, and they felt that this would somehow prevent them from getting bookings in certain circles or getting the money they get when they go out because they are an oldies act. Because when you lump them in with other people, they've got big bellies and they wear polyester suits, and certain people aren't in those groupings. So they didn't want to be on that kind of show. So there was two reasons why I had to change the format. The first was there was no way to return the investment on a third sequel because a third of a third would have been a loss situation. There would have been no way to make this happen, especially after the costs of all the music and the music publishing and the music rights and all. There was no way. So there wasn't going to be a third pure doo-wop show. I had an option. I either could have maybe found some way to convince someone to give us money to do kind of, you know, what happened with the third doo-wop box set where it was absolutely the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
Or I could have found a way to expand this and keep this going. And that's what I did. I said, wait a second, let me think here. What if we expand this a little bit? Because as many people that love doo-wop also love the pop sounds of the 50s and the 60s. So maybe the Four Seasons aren't a doo-wop group, but Frankie Valli meant the same to people in the 60s as the Mellow Kings meant to us in the 50s. So what is it we can do to give something to the doo-wop people, like me, I'm one of the doo-wop people, that we haven't seen before, but then also bring in interests of other people like Little Richard. Little Richard meant just as much to the 50s as the Cleftones did, and more.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Cleftones. My favorite song is You Baby You. Actually, Why You Do Me Like You Do is my absolute favorite by them. Of course, Pittsburgh is Lover Boy. but my point is, Little Richard meant more to the 50s, or as much to the 50s, as did the Cleftones. Even though I love the Cleftones, Little Richard meant just as much as the Cleftones to this entire country as the Cleftones did. So there's people that had that interest too that wanted to see Little Richard, and there was no tape of him on a gathering like this. You can't just go out and buy a Little Richard video. I mean, I guess you could buy a bootleg, but
yeah.
I mean, not commonly in stores, and you weren't seeing him on TV. So Little Richard deserved to be on a show like this. Then you had people like Kathy Young and The Innocents. I mean, we know The Innocents is doo-wop. There's from Gee Whiz and songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy Young, I mean, she deserved to be recorded for her part in history. Now, is she a doo-wop artist? No. Is she pop? Yes. The Fleetwood, same story. Are they any more or less than a group like The Chimes? I don't know. You got to decide that. It depends what you like. Once in a while, I'm in the mood for love. Did that have the same feeling or impact to you as 1,000 Stars in the Sky? But it did have an impact to a lot of people because it was a big record. So my thought was, if I could somehow expand this so that a third of it were people that kind of like the pre-Beatles American rock and roll and not just lump it into one style of music. And then I can get the very best of the people that we couldn't get before for these other reasons. And then expand it to attract a slightly younger group of people that would have, you know, for example, the Jay Black people. I know what Jay Black does to an audience when he sings Karamia. That needed to be on TV. I know what Lou Christie's talent is. People needed to see what he meant. I know what it's like to see the Contours gyrating. I mean, here's guys that have been completely forgotten by history. And they had some amazing records,
mm-hmm.
forgotten by their own record label, for that matter. Do those people deserve any less than Little Anthony and the original Imperials? I don't think so. So my idea was, if I could just expand this a little bit, not forgetting the core, not doing what everybody else in the world does and say, oh, we're never going to play a 50s record again on the radio because anybody who listens to that is over the age of 54 and we're not interested. That wasn't my goal. My goal was, if I could just expand this a little bit so it gets a little younger, gets a couple more interests, then maybe those interests with that third that was left from the doo-wop people, well, maybe that would get me to be able to do more of these shows. So it just wouldn't be a third show, and that was the end of it. And don't you know, the third show, Rock Rhythm and Doo-Wop, it's not completely done yet. We'll know for sure in March, but looks to have raised almost the same amount of money as Doo-Wop 50.
Wow.
That's a third sequel. A third sequel, raising twice the money of the second sequel.
That's amazing.
Now, here's what that means to me. I have a shot to maybe do more shows. And that was my goal. I didn't want to just end it here because there's too many other groups out there that belong on this, what this work is that we have to do together. So that's the good news, and that's why you saw what happened with Rock Rhythm and Doo-Wop. It happened that way because there was no way to do a third show alone and get the money it took to do the show and also make it in a way where there could be any more shows beyond that. This opened the door to allow us to access all those people who loved Little Richard, all those people who loved the Duprees, all those people who loved Joey D and the Starlighters, and all those people that loved the Casinos. But then you got all those people that loved Lloyd Price, and on the same show, you got all those people that loved Ed Townsend, and all those people who loved Lenny Welch, and all those people who loved the Limelights, and that was the goal here. And as a result of that, we're now doing a fourth show, and I'm able to now go and find all those groups that I just mentioned to you that otherwise there was no shot of getting recorded for history. So it's not a question of me selling out. It's just the opposite. It really is exactly the opposite. My intent here is to keep this thing going as long as we can. It's amazing the emails that I get from people that say, why don't you use this group, or what's wrong with you? Why didn't you use that group? And sometimes I have to reply and say, well, we offered them. They didn't take the job because there wasn't enough money in it for them. There was enough money in it for Little Richard, but not for them, and it was the same amount of money. So you understand there's reasons as to why, and they all come down to legal and business reasons. It all comes down to money at the end of the day, but it's not because I don't care about doo-wop. I haven't gotten what I'm getting, and that's it. I'm moving on. It's just that I can't see why somebody like the Fleetwoods, like Gary Truxell of the Fleetwoods, isn't just as deserving as Willie and the Harptones of getting recorded for history. And if we can do that, why we also can't honor the people that we've yet to get, that I've yet to find. I don't see why it has to stop. And that's all I'm trying to do is keep it going, but you got to understand that keeping it going means you have to appeal to as many people as possible. They need to give you money. I mean, you see what's happening market after market. You've got more and more internet radio shows. Why? Because commercial radio shows are not going to be playing doo-wops in 5 years from now. Trust me, they're not going to do it. The reason? Because everybody's over 54 and their advertisers don't want it. Ken Held, off the air. Little Walter, off the air. And some of our big markets, and you could say, oh, but look, Harvey Holliday. Yeah, Harvey Holliday's on 3 hours a week. You think it's going to be like that in 8 more years from now when his listening audience goes from being 60 to 70?
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
That's not what I'm trying to do here. I don't want this thing to die with the third show. I want it to go on because as long as these people are still alive, my mission is to be able to get them and to give them that respect and credit they deserve. And that's what I'm trying to do the best way I know how. And guess what? The trick worked because we're doing a fourth show. And I'm able to find these people and a whole bunch more that I contractually can't mention to you now, but they're big, big names and big, big reunions of doo-wop music and also of pop music and also of 60s rock music, because having all these avenues that are going to get us to where we want to get to at the end of the day. So I read this stuff and I see this stuff, and it's not that I don't care. I care a lot. You know, I love to get the Manhattan Temptations to come out and do Barbara. It's like one of my favorite songs. Love that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't do that because if I do just a show with the Devotions and all that roulette stuff, that'll be great for the hardcore doo-wop people, and we may sell 500 tapes. We'll never, ever do a doo-wop show again, ever, because nobody will ever, you know, want to be associated with it.
Right.
And that's it. It's over. I am trying to do just the opposite. And what people have to understand is maybe, okay, I understand. You're not a Lou Christie fan. I understand that. I'm not a Lou Christie fan. I'm not. Somebody is. He sold a lot of records. He had the number one record of the country in 1966. And it's money from those Lou Christie fans last year that is now allowing me to find the chords. So if it wasn't for the Lou Christie fans, if it wasn't for the Lenny Welch fans, if it wasn't for the Kathy Young and the Innocent fans, if it wasn't for the Contours fans that liked that, you never would have saw what you're about to see, and you certainly wouldn't have seen the collection of people we had on the stage. So don't forget that. I'm not asking people to agree with it. If you don't like a certain song, don't listen to it. But stay with us because there's going to be something on next, and it's the people that do like that song that are giving you what you like too. And we can't forget that. I think what happens is we all just get too close to it because, hey, if I had my preference, it would be all Motown, B-sides, and all doo-wops all the time. But it ain't going to happen.
Well, TJ, I certainly appreciate what you're doing. I think I can speak for my listeners in Northern California. We love the shows. We're pleased that you're doing them. We certainly want you to do more, and we certainly support you in the efforts that you're doing to get these performers the recognition that they deserve.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing your next show, and I certainly appreciate the fact that you've taken time out of your really busy schedule to do this interview with me.
Yeah, well, like I said, this is not an ego thing. It really isn't. I have work to do. We have work to do. We need to be able to get these guys for history. This is something for their grandchildren to see 30 years from now. This is something for your grandchildren to see 30 years from now to have a better appreciation as to, you know, what your music was. I wish I had that for my grandparents because I would like to understand what it is they loved about Kay Kaiser. And I have no reference of that, really. There's no video that they could pull out that shows all that. And that's all we're trying to do here. And the only way I get to do that is through your listeners. And I thank them enough. And I'm not looking to be thanked. I'm just looking to be able to do more of these shows. And I understand, you know, you just want to get to the concert and you see that 20 minutes of begging, Jesus, when are they going to get past this? And another comment we get a lot of times, why do you show all the good stuff on the video and not on TV? Well, why do you buy the cow if you get the milk for free? That's not what we're about. It's the people who give to these shows that allow us to do these shows. And if you're a member and you understand what we're about, what we're trying to do, and if you believe in us and if you help us, we're going to do more, and we've lived up to that promise. I wish we could do more of it throughout the regular schedule, and we're working on that, but that's really expensive. I guess the message is don't thank me. Thank you. Thank your listeners, because it's their dollars that allowed us to bring Fred Parris out of retirement. It's their dollars that allowed us to have Anthony on that stage doing what he did. It's their dollars that allowed Ed Townsend, for the first time in 40 years, one night, one moment back on stage so that people finally knew who he was, because his records aren't even played on the radio anymore. So.